This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you know anything about Dan Snyder, owner of the NFL team in Washington, D.C., you know he has steadfastly refused to consider changing the name of his team, no matter how many fans, politicians, and Native Americans have charged that the name is a racial slur. There's more. Snyder sued fans who couldn't pay for their season tickets during the 2008-2009 financial collapse. He's gone through head coaches the way other teams go through rolls of athletic tape, and since he bought the team in 1999, the Washington club has lost 76 more games than it has won. But Dan Snyder has a fan.
My name is Ricky Jean Francois, number 99 of the Washington Redskins. I'm a professional football player.
After his team beat Baltimore 2 weeks ago, Ricky Jean Francois, 6'3", 313 pounds, got a text. It came from teammate Pierre Garçon, who wanted to know if Francois wanted to go to Haiti.
And I sat there for a minute, and I was like, well, how are we going to Haiti? Like, we getting on American Airlines, Delta or something? But it was like, no, Dan Snyder offered to lend us his jet and to send some supplies with us to take to Haiti.
This is the same Dan Snyder who's been accused of jacking up ticket prices. Same Dan Snyder inclined to sue journalists who criticize him. Yep, same guy was sending his private jet full of supplies to Haiti with two of the players he employs. Francois got the call because, like Pierre Garçon, his roots are in Haiti. Francois's father was born there. Though the family moved to Florida before he came along, his dad had always said that someday they'd make a trip to the island together. Now Francois was about to make his first visit with a teammate rather than with his dad.
And I told Pierre, I'm like, sure, if we can go, just tell me the time and what we need to wear. And from that point on that day, I was nervous as hell.
Who wouldn't be nervous about flying into an area that had just been clobbered by winds of up to 130 miles an hour? The United Nations Humanitarian Agency had reported that 750,000 Haitians would need life-saving assistance over the next 3 months. Reports suggested that about 20% of Haiti's 11 million people had been affected to some extent by Hurricane Matthew.
But this ain't a book in front of you now. Now you're actually finna be encountering with people. You're finna actually go to a place that's devastated after a hurricane.
The night before he departed for Haiti, as Dan Snyder's plane was being loaded with relief supplies, Francois barely slept. The next morning, once Francois and Garçon were in the air, the nervousness only increased.
I don't know what I'm finna encounter. I don't know how people there take up for a disaster. Are we gonna see bodies? Are we gonna see debris? Are we gonna, like, everything just running through my head. Pierre tried to keep me calm, but that wasn't going to happen. We tried to play cards. We tried to talk, but my whole mind was just set on, when this plane touched down, what am I going to see when I open that door of this jet?
When the plane landed, what Ricky Jean Francois saw, much to his relief, was a rescue effort underway.
I seen military choppers, big heavy ones coming in and out, and as soon as you hit a door, you can hear the propellers of those choppers, 3-4 of them at a time just going, and you're just seeing soldiers running back and forth, throwing boxes, throwing different supplies on choppers because some of the roads that they needed to get to weren't there anymore, and the storm took it. So the only way they can get there was through these choppers to drop off supplies, medical supplies, food, so on and so on.
Soon, Francois and Garçon, proudly wearing their burgundy and gold Washington game jerseys, were taken to a nearby hospital.
As soon as the supplies got out of the truck, the box was already being ripped open. They was already putting IVs up. They was already using alcohol. They was already using peroxide. Everything that came inside those boxes that Dan Snyder helped us deliver, it was being put to use. That's why you can see the nurses were smiling.
Inside the hospital, there were fewer smiles.
We went inside one of the recovery rooms. And the lady was telling us, don't pass a certain line. And I was asking her, like, why can't we pass this line? Because she said, you don't know what you may encounter, what you may look at. Because say if somebody just had a surgery and they didn't have gauze or have the right proper tools to sew it up, or you was going to run into smells that you're just not used to smelling every day. Imagine somebody telling you or your family member that we have to turn you down because we don't have the equipment to either help you or either save your life.
And though the hospital was poorly equipped, and though patients were crowded into rooms where the beds were wall to wall, the ones whom the players were able to visit were pleased.
Everybody's eyes just went big. They knew on the back of our jersey we had Haitian names, and you just seen them just look at us the whole time like nobody really said anything. Everybody was just nervous as hell. They just wanted to just sit there and just look at us. So I was like, I don't mind. If you do want to take a picture, that's cool, but if you don't, I'm not going to be mad. people are actually smiling because they seen people are willing to come there now and help, not just say, oh, let's pray for Haiti or let's cut a check. Nah, let's bring things to them that they're praying for. That would put the smile on their face when they actually seen us in person.
After his 24-hour trip, Francois returned to the U.S. with a sense of Haiti's ongoing need, but also with an appreciation for the people he'd met.
At the end of the day, the Haitian people keep taking licks, but at the same time, we're not going to fall. We're not going to stay down for a long period of time. We're going to get back up, and we're going to get back to grinding because we know we have loved ones we need to take care of. It's a bigger picture to it.
The Haitians had survived earthquakes and hurricanes in the past, and they do it again. And Ricky Jean Francois plans to continue to assist them. After the football season, Francois intends to take his father up on that promised trip to Haiti, though it will be a return trip for both of them, and a trip imbued with greater purpose.
Now it made me want to see, can I get to that Muhammad Ali pedestal of when I open my mouth, people from around the world would actually hear me and be willing to help. Because at one point, I was just an average person. But when people see me step up with my teammate, Pierre, and my owner, Dan Snyder, it's like I had a voice of a sound barrier. If I said one thing, it just went off.
The private jet full of supplies helped some of the many people in great need, and the trip woke Ricky Jean Francois to the possibility of a higher calling than next week's game. And if it serves as a reminder that people are complicated, all people, even a man who clings stubbornly to a team name that's shameful at best and at worst obscene, well, perhaps there's benefit there as well. On Thursday night, the L.A. Sparks beat the Minnesota Lynx to become champions of the WNBA. Dramatic only begins to describe how it happened. The Sparks won Game 1 of the best-of-five series by a point when Alana Beard, known for her defense, drained a last-second shot from the corner. They won Game 5, also by 1 point, when Nneka Ogumike grabbed a rebound, missed a shot, grabbed her own rebound, and made a shot while falling on her back. She had plenty of time, relatively. There were 2 seconds left. Before the series began, the underdog Sparks had reminded each other that all they had to do was win 3 games by 1 point. The Sparks must have forgotten that when they won Game 3 by 17 points, but 2 out of 3 ain't bad, and now they're champs. But unless you were in the Target Center or watching the game at home, you probably didn't see it, and that's because sports bars don't generally show WNBA games. Maya Goldberg-Safer isn't satisfied with that.
It's October in Chicago. My friend Sarah and I step out of her apartment and into her twinkling, bar-lined neighborhood with purpose. If they can't do it, we'll have to leave, I say. We have no other choice, Sarah nods. Tonight, we have one goal. To get a drink at a sports bar while watching the do-or-die Chicago Sky playoff game. That's right. We want to watch women's basketball. At a bar. In public. I mean, they'll probably have it on, right? Sarah says. Oh, Sarah. This is my 20th year watching the WNBA. Ever since the league started in 1997, when I was 7, and playing ball at every recess. I had no idea how quickly I'd get fed up with myself in the basketball gym, or that I'd tearfully quit my elite AAU team suddenly at age 13. And I didn't know how fascinated I'd become with the players who kept playing, women whose bodies move with breathtaking strength, often discarding notions of femininity like an extra sweat towel. These days, I'm so taken with WNBA professionals that sometimes I make the trek alone to Rosemont, the Chicago suburb where the Sky play home games, to watch them compete, across from a restaurant equipment warehouse, in a stadium pockmarked with fans. Now I'm dragging Sarah along with me. We duck into a cavernous sports bar. Sarah asks the bartender, "Excuse me, would you mind changing one of these to ESPN2? "What's on ESPN2? He says. "It's the Chicago Sky playoff game," and the bartender stares back, then gets his act together. "I'm sorry, we have trivia tonight, actually, and we need to have the Blackhawks on this TV and this one, and this one." He points to all the TVs in the bar. Then he shrugs, almost generously. "It's just that we just can't." Sarah and I leave quickly. The game has already started. "What about over there?" She points to the next sports bar, a little more excited now. this has become a quest. We approach the High Dive, a bar known for its chicken wing special. I really hope this one works out. And I declare to the bouncer, "So, we want to watch the WNBA. Would you guys put it on?" "Oh, I'm down with that. Definitely down with that," says the bouncer guy, who's not a bouncer at all. He's an angel. "But they just want to watch hockey here. You gotta ask the bartender." We have found an ally. Sure enough, inside there are a bunch of dudes scattered around the bar, the Blackhawks preseason game shining on all four television monitors. Then we notice. It's the greatest sight we've witnessed all night. The bartender. She's a woman. "Hey, could we, do you think ESPN2, any of the, yeah, over there? Yes!" Sarah and I launch at the bar all at once. And just 10 minutes later, I forgive her, the remote was acting really funky. Voila! We're watching Chicago's very own professional women's basketball team battling to keep their playoff run alive.
If Chicago is able to come back and win this game, we will see you Thursday night in Los Angeles.
And yes, the hockey-watching men scoff and smirk. And yes, I already know the Sky will get pummeled by the Los Angeles Sparks. And yes, these players still earn a relatively measly salary decades behind the earnings of the NBA. Right now, I don't care. Because we're drinking cheap beer and eating an excellent chicken wing special at just another sports bar. All while watching women, most of them black and many of them queer, compete on a nationally overrated, I mean broadcast, sports network. As soon as the server comes to take our order, we offer to buy her a shot. She agrees. "To women," we toast. It is a small, bright victory.
That's Maya Goldberg Safer. A version of her story first appeared on the women's website, The Hairpin, and you can find the link at onlyagame.org. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but before we get back to it, I'd like to thank Quinn Owen, who posted a glowing review of our podcast on iTunes, saying, "While I'm not a sports fan, I am addicted to Only a Game." Gee, that's what a lot of people said back in the pre-podcast days of snail mail. Consider joining Quinn Owen with a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. It's week 7 of the NFL season. Fans of the 0-6 Browns, the 1-6 Bears, and the 1-5 Panthers have reason to be disgruntled, and they aren't the only ones. Some fans of teams that are winning have been grumbling as well, and that's where we're going to begin this week's three stories you should know. My guests this time around are the Boston Globe's Shira Springer and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Don, what's going on in the No Fun League?
Well, Giants wide receiver Victor Cruz dances a touchdown salsa while fellow receiver Odell Beckham Jr. mimics taking his picture. Mm-hmm. Penalty flag, 15 yards. After a touchdown, Eagles tight end Vernon Davis does a jump shot by flinging the football over the goalpost. Penalty flag, 15 yards. Cardinals defenders Chandler Jones and DJ Swearinger recover a fumble. They dance a little jig. Not a very good one, by the way. Penalty flag, 15 yards. During the first 4 weeks of this season, unsportsmanlike penalty flags are up 56%. Now, some of these unsportsmanlike calls are reasonable, of course, but many just feel petty and stupidly punitive. As Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post wrote this week, "These calls are not only incredibly quibbling, interruptive, and unfair, they have a boot-on-the-neck quality that is actually uncomfortable for the audience." And it just seems really ridiculous that the penalty for helmet-to-helmet contact is exactly the same for the penalty for using a football as a pillow.
All right, Shira, I really hope you're going to come out against fun, because I'm not, and otherwise we got nothing here.
I hate to disappoint you, Bill, but I'm all for fun, and I'm right there in agreement with Don and with Sally Jenkins. I mean, I would love to see more personality displayed by NFL players. Now, I will sort of try to understand where the NFL is coming from.
Oh, thank goodness, a little creative tension.
I was going to say, yes, exactly. Some of the celebrations that have been done by players in the past have, let's say, not been family friendly. I think there was a player for Seattle, I believe it was Doug Baldwin, who during the Super Bowl celebrated a touchdown by pretending to go to the bathroom, and the football was the end product of that effort. So you can sort of understand where the NFL might be coming from in the sense that there are some celebrations that are inappropriate. But my belief is these celebrations can be quite creative and clever. You want three-dimensional people out there. You don't want automatons.
Did anybody laugh at Roger Goodell when he most recently defended this rule by saying these players are all role models and that's why they shouldn't be celebrating? Especially given the news that surfaced at the end of this week, the NFL's mishandling of its most recent domestic violence case, this one against Josh Brown. I think it's time to retire forever, this old role model argument.
You're right, Bill. It just looks like the priorities of the league are misplaced yet again.
I would like to talk a little bit about quote-unquote amateur sports. This week, the NCAA charged the Louisville men's basketball program with four so-called major violations in connection with what has become known as the escort scandal. The idea here seems to be that even if head coach Rick Pitino didn't know that one of his assistants was hiring women to entertain athletes and recruits, Pitino is responsible for whatever mischief and mayhem goes on in the program. But let's assume Pitino really didn't know what his assistants, or at least one of them, was doing. I don't know if he should be penalized. Beyond that, the larger issue alert here, maybe this stuff should all be handled by the same people at the university who handle students who aren't athletes when they do dumb or criminal things. I'm thinking deans, and then beyond that, police officers and judges and people like that. Am I dreaming when I suggest that athletes who break the rules or the law should be treated like band members or debate club captains who do same thing? I'm dreaming. Okay.
Well, you know, obviously Rick Pitino is one of the biggest control freaks in college athletics. So it's a really big if that he didn't know what's going on here.
Absolutely.
There's a newish NCAA bylaw on head coach responsibility, which creates a presumption that a head coach is responsible for the actions of his staff unless he can overcome that presumption by showing that he promoted an atmosphere of compliance and monitored the actions of his staff. So good luck. It's going to be a tough sell.
I was going to say it's going to be a very tough sell. I'm someone who covered Rick Pitino when he coached the Celtics, and he was a control freak then, and it was part of, you know, what caused his downfall here in Boston. And I'm with you, Don. I find it very, very, very hard to believe that he knew nothing. But I think larger picture, this is his program. Everything that happens within that program is a reflection of Rick Pitino. So he sets the tone with his staff, with his players, and he clearly set a tone where they thought this was permissible. You can't be responsible for what happens on the court and then say, oh, this is happening in the dormitory. Not my responsibility. You can't do that. That's why head coaches get paid the big bucks, because they are these people who oversee everything, who are these control freaks, who touch every part of the program.
I would argue with one thing that you said. I think coaches get paid the big bucks for winning basketball games and making the alumni happy enough to give a lot of money to the university. And when they stop winning, they stop getting paid the big bucks until they move on to another university and do it again. Let's assume that you're right and that Pitino should be held responsible for this. But can we look down the line at some point where student athletes are really student athletes and therefore it's not some outside organization, in this case the NCAA, that comes in and makes all the rules and says here's how it's going to work, where students are treated as students and basketball coaches are perhaps paid a little less?
You know you're still dreaming.
Yes, of course. And it's what I do. All right, Shira, what have you got for us?
Well, news this week left me wondering, how far will runners go for prize money, the $2,000 or $3,000 that is awarded at local road races? Well, apparently there's a chance that they'll take performance-enhancing drugs to win that money. And that explains why the New York Road Runners, one of the largest road racing organizations in the country, announced plans this week to expand its drug testing to top finishers in its local races. And there are about 20 or 30 or 40 plus of those local races. I like the message that the New York Road Runners is sending. Basically, they're saying, we're watching you. We're going to try to keep at least all levels of our sport clean, and we take this very seriously, and we want you to take this seriously, too. Unfortunately, I think that's where we are now in the sports world, where we've got to police doping at all levels, both amateur and pro. I'm just curious, you know, what do you guys think of this? I mean, is this what we've come to?
I think so. I think it's really unfortunate. You have to assume the worst at every level. We had the Little League cheating scandal just a couple of years ago that proves that. Doping and cheating are rampant. You have to trust but verify at every level. I agree. Shira, it sends just, I think, a fantastic message throughout amateur sports that, you know, if you're going to take a PED to win your local 5K, somebody might be looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
I have no idea how many people do take performance-enhancing drugs in order to win five-mile races in Palookaville.
The local turkey trot.
I just don't know. Yeah. I'm ignorant about that. Right. But the one thing that worries me about this is that the current drug testing programs are sketchy at best. Cheaters often get away with cheating. People who have no intention to cheat often get suspended because they've eaten something off the health store shelf that's got something that's banned. And until the system is better, I just don't see that it's a great idea to expand it.
You know what? I agree with you, Bill. I agree with this is a very complex system for pro athletes to navigate, and they have private coaches and doctors at their beck and call. I can only imagine.
Who can help them find the drugs that they need to win?
Yes, yes, yes. But I can only imagine, you know, how difficult it's going to be to for just your average amateur to navigate.
It is an imperfect system. Yeah. It sends a great message. But, Bill, your point is a good one. The drug testing system, you know, at the Olympic level is suspect and has all sorts of issues. At the amateur level, what's it going to be like?
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been the Boston Globe Shira Springer and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Thank you both for showing up this week.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
Ever had one of those nightmares where you end up in a job that you're not quite prepared for and lots of people are watching? It's terrible, right? Well, that's the sort of thing that happened to 26-year-old Scotty Walden, but in real life. Our story begins about a decade ago. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
When Scotty Walden arrived in Cleburne, Texas, before his junior year of high school, he had a lot to get used to. Walden had grown up near Fort Worth. Cleburne is 30 miles south of the city. The population is 29,000 people. Everyone seems to know each other, and everyone seems to know a lot about horses. The reason behind the move from the city was simple: money. Walden's mom was a single parent, and cash was tight. Cleburne was cheap. Walden had a good relationship with his father, but he lived far away.
So, obviously, just like a lot of kids, I would always look for that father figure. I would always look for that man. Who's that man in my life? Who's that role model that I can look up to, that male figure?
In Cleburne, Scotty Walden found that role model. His name was Phil Young, and he was the high school football coach.
Just the most down-to-earth, family, Christian man, off the field, would treat everyone he saw with respect and never act like he was above anybody. Just the type of man I wanted to be. But then when you got on that football field, he was a fierce competitor. That's when I definitely figured out I wanted to be a coach.
Scotty Walden imagined coaching under Phil Young at Cleburne High. But first, he had his own playing career to worry about. He was good enough to quarterback at Division III Sol Ross State University in West Texas. But even then, Walden daydreamed of being on the sidelines with the clipboard.
I'd be in class in college and stuff, and yeah, I was a history major, so you'd have those long lectures, and so sometime I'd start drawing up plays in my notebook.
Those scribbled plays would come in handy much sooner than Scotty Walden could have predicted, because after his playing career ended in 2011, Walden took a low-paying gig as a graduate assistant at Sol Ross, a nice way to ease into the coaching profession, he must have thought. But when the team's offensive coordinator stepped down, the Sol Ross head coach surprised Walden and everybody else. He handed over control of the offense to the 22-year-old.
I can see that whole picture right now, sitting in his office and him telling me, you go do you, and I trust you. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me. This is more than I mean, first I was excited, but then immediate stress, immediate pressure kind of set in.
The offensive coordinator designs and calls plays for the team to run when it has the football. It's a job that requires an entire playbook. Scotty Walden had some notebook doodles from history class. So he went to the place most 22-year-old kids on college campuses go when they need to get a lot of work done, the library.
I was probably there about 4 hours, something like that. And I just drew the number 0 to 99 on the board, and I just started labeling the plays. All right, 0 is going to be this, 1 is going to be this, 2 is going to be this. And by the time I left there that day, that first time, I can't remember if I had all 0 through 99, but I had majority of them. I had the formations, what I wanted to call them.
At that point, did you think these plays would work?
I had no clue. No, I didn't.
Whether his plays would work wasn't the only thing weighing on Scotty Walden. The bigger question was, would the guys on his team, who had been his teammates a few months earlier, respect him as their new coach? He decided he had to address that issue at his first meeting with the offense.
I'll tell you what, it was intimidating. I'm young. I'm the same age as those guys in the room. There's actually several players on the team that are older than me. You know, one of our stud receivers that I threw the ball to the year before was 26 years old. I was 22. You know, how's he going to listen to me?
But Walden's message was firm.
And I told him that, you know, we've got to draw a line in the sand where you guys got to realize that I'm your coach. I'm not your buddy. I'm not a player anymore. I'm here for you and I love you and I'm going to do everything I can for you. But you got to realize the position I'm in.
The players got it. Even the 26-year-old wide receiver.
After the meeting, he's like, Coach, you know I got you. And I'm bought in and whatever you say, let's roll with it. Let's go.
In Sol Ross's first two games, Walden's offense put up 44 and 35 points. But the opposing offenses put up more, and the team started the season with a pair of losses. Next up was Trinity University, the number 11 team in the country.
No one gave us a chance, and we were doing some good stuff on offense up to that point, but we hadn't exploded yet. And that day we exploded, and we beat those guys 62 to 35, and that was the funnest game I've ever been a part of. And I distinctly remember when the fourth quarter was winding down, and I just remember thinking to myself that I don't want to do anything else. I wanted to coach, you know, for the rest of my life.
The team finished out the season with a 5-5 record. But Walden's offense? Well, Sol Ross averaged 48.8 points per game and led the entire NCAA that year, Divisions 1, 2, and 3, with 581.9 yards per game. After the season, Walden moved across the state into the offensive coordinator position at Division 3 East Texas Baptist University. His new office reflected his age. He had posters for professional wrestling and a TV show about a zombie apocalypse. In that office, Walden drew up plays that put East Texas Baptist among the top point scorers in all of Division III. Then, this past January, ETBU head coach Josh Ergel approached his offensive coordinator.
Coach Ergel walks up to me and says, hey, you want to be the head football coach at ETBU? And I said, what are you talking about, man? What's going on?
What was going on was Ergel was leaving for a job at a Division I program. That same night, Walden was called in for an interview with the university president, provost, head of enrollment, and athletic director. By the time the interview ended a little before midnight, Walden had been offered the job.
The very next morning, I accepted the job to be the head football coach.
At that point, did you know that you were the youngest coach in the NCAA?
No, had no clue, and nor was I thinking about that. I was thinking about all the things I had to do immediately. It was kind of like, again, the Sol Ross situation, again, magnified times 10. It was, all right, recruiting, academics, study hall, workouts, the coaches, let's look at the Ross. You know, I hadn't even had time to think about, look at, okay, here's the players we're losing, here's who we got to replace. So definitely a stressful time.
10 months later, Scotty Walden, now 26, seems to have settled comfortably into his new role. His team started the season 5-1, and his offense continues to put up 50-plus points on a regular basis. But one thing did change when Walden moved into his new role. The wrestling and zombie posters had to come down.
Because I'm the head guy now, so I can't have them in the head coach's office.
Perhaps the youngest football coach in America is growing up. Many are already speculating that he will move into a Division I head coaching job while he's still among the same generation as his players. And there's been an unexpected benefit.
You know, it's been a blessing. I really believe it was in God's plan that I came out here to East Texas to have a football job because my dad lives out here in East Texas. So he and I, our relationship has developed even further since I've been out here. Sometimes I'm just like, dude, you are insanely blessed and just lucky to have a career that you know you want to do.
That's East Texas Baptist University head football coach Scotty Walden speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. To read more about Coach Walden, check out Vice Sports' recent story, The Great Expectations of Scotty Walden. You can find a link at onlyagame.org. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Coming up on Only a Game, Jim MacDonald is a Notre Dame football diehard and his daughter Liz wasn't.
Do you remember yelling or stomping around the house?
Yes. These are things that now I'm ashamed of.
Just ahead, a father and daughter come full circle over the Fighting Irish, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, Shaquille O'Neal reads from his latest book for children, and I can assure you, Dr. Big Aristotle will delight. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I can genuinely say I can hardly wait. And I'd like to say hello to people who are getting in under the wire just in time. Our new listeners in Gainesville, Florida on 89.1 WUFT, Woofed Radio.
Excellent.
Are going to get in just in time to hear Shaquille O'Neal next week.
And they'll like it too, I'm sure. The Cleveland Indians won the American League pennant on Wednesday afternoon. And when he took the mound for the clinching game, Game 5, Ryan Merritt had been the starting pitcher in one previous Major League game. One. I guess Cleveland manager Terry Francona had the Blue Jays right where he wanted them that afternoon.
He did. He threw 4 1/3 scoreless innings, and they won the ALCS. They're going to the World Series. And he's also getting married, and somebody, I'm sure was well-meaning, but you know, probably doomed Merritt and his fiancée to 933 juicers, let out his wedding registry, which has now been swamped by sports guys. Like this guy, his Twitter handle is Positive Tribe, and he said, "If I can't buy World Series tickets, I'll buy 700 thread count sheets for the new Prince of Cleveland and his princess." Good for you, Positive Tribe. Nothing says old-time baseball like Bed Bath & Beyond.
Charlie, we have talked about how Chicago GM Theo Epstein would be celebrated if the Cubs win the World Series. Does Terry Francona, managing the Red Sox when they finally won in 2004, go directly to the Hall of Fame if the Indians win the series for the first time since 1948?
Well, Bill, he goes directly to my Hall of Fame, which is really the only one that counts. Yeah, I mean, this would be an extraordinary accomplishment for him. And he's managed extremely well in Cleveland the whole time he's been
under
there.
Under not ideal circumstances.
No, not at all.
When your starting pitcher lasts four batters and is bleeding all over the mound and you have to go to bullpen that early, that's not easy. In a recent poll, the majority of the NBA's 30 general managers predicted that LeBron James will be the MVP this season. That doesn't particularly surprise me. I was a little surprised that so few experts picked Steph Curry for that distinction. What about you?
Yeah, I think some folks are overthinking it a little bit. They're figuring that Steph Curry's numbers will fall off because of the presence of Kevin Durant. I just think Kevin Durant's going to get the same numbers he always did, and so will Steph Curry.
This week, Dr. Bennett Omalu disclosed that the late Jordan Parsons is the first mixed martial artist to be diagnosed with CTE. Parsons was killed in May by a hit-and-run driver. Any idea whether the MMA world will deal with this sad reality any better than the NFL or the NHL have done?
I don't know how you deal with it if you're not willing to change the nature of your sport. And if you change the nature of mixed martial arts, you don't have a sport anymore. You know, once again, you know, it's this very bizarre collision of public health and essentially libertarianism as practiced by athletes. Mm. But the only thing you can do is hammer away at the warning to every athlete engaged in these sports. Look, this is the inevitable result of a career in this particular sport. You can't avoid it. This is part of the deal you make when you take on this career.
New York Giants kicker Josh Brown was suspended this season for one game after an investigation into allegations of domestic abuse made by his now ex-wife. New documents have surfaced that show that Brown admitted to verbally and physically abusing this woman on multiple occasions. Another mess the NFL has handled poorly.
It's extraordinary. I don't know how many times they have to screw up on this particular front to realize they need a change at management at the very, very top. Nobody in this story comes out well. certainly the owner of the New York Giants doesn't come out well. Roger Goodell doesn't come out well because he's Roger Goodell, and it's impossible for him to come out well because he doesn't know what he's doing.
He doesn't even follow his own rules, the ones that he establishes. He doesn't follow the pathetic penalties
he put in place. And I'm still trying to get my head around how these documents, which were obviously part of some sort of therapy Josh Brown was undergoing, and to my mind, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I play one on Only a Game, these have to be privileged. Who the hell leaks privileged medical information? The overwhelming fact remains is that Josh Brown got off incredibly easy and that Roger Goodell shouldn't be parking cars at the NFL, let alone running the league.
Tiger Woods, last heard from withdrawing from last week's Safeway Open, said in an interview on Thursday that he believes he will break Jack Nicklaus's record of 18 major championships. Mr. Woods has 14. Does this seem likely to
you? No, and this is one of the great surprises of my life. When I wrote what has become an infamous article about Tiger Woods in 1997, I said categorically he was going to beat that record. I'm amazed that he's not going to. Hmm. But you know what? He's not going to.
Five-year-old sports fan Louis Kayes had to go to a birthday party last weekend, and this meant that he had to miss Celtic FC playing Motherwell in Scotland. He called the Celtic FC front office to say he was sorry, and a representative of the club called him back to say thank you for calling. I wonder maybe if everybody who has a season ticket and misses games ought to call and say, I'm sorry, I can't be there.
Wait a minute. This kid does a remarkable thing, and he gets thank you for calling in return?
He should get a jersey.
He should sit
least.
On the damn bench for the rest of the year. Lewis, come on, man. This is the golden ticket.
And finally, we have a story out of Quebec where a thief broke into a sporting goods store last weekend and made off with $150,000 worth of hockey sticks. And if you were the constable leading the investigation, where do you go to look for this miscreant?
Apparently, he took his time.
First
of all, let's just say that the guy came into the store through the ceiling, and the name of the store is Monkey Sports. Thank you very much. But that aside, he apparently picked the ones that were the most valuable.
Precisely.
And he walked away with $150,000 worth of high-end hockey sticks. What's he going to do with them? Is he going to set up a stand? Is there someplace you go to fence high-end hockey sticks? I mean, is you know, Louis and Trois-Rivières in a market for, you know, 150, not even autographed, for God's sakes.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Zout alors, Bill.
Growing up in Kansas City, Liz McDonald was perplexed by her father's obsession with sports. Now, as an adult, she is starting to understand. Liz and her father, Jim, tell their story in their own words.
So we're just going to chat extemporaneously about the issues, or?
Yeah, I've got some questions here for you, Dad. So
okay, all right, well,
yeah.
Let's go.
So that's my dad. His name is Jim McDonald. Sports were a huge presence in my home growing up. My dad, you know, he had his chair, which is kind of like the Archie Bunker chair. It was a big beige leather Lazy Boy recliner. If the game was going well, he would be kind of kicked back with the recliner up. But if things were not going well, then it would definitely be kind of a leaned forward in the chair on the edge of his seat kind of thing. We had probably five or six televisions in the house with VCRs attached to them, and it was always this struggle to find a place where I could watch my cartoons or whatever it was I wanted to watch on TV, because chances were he was taping a game. So my first question for you is, what about you would have to sometimes go out into the world when you'd be recording a game at home? What was that experience like?
Well, it was tough because, first of all, I have to warn everybody that I came in contact with that I'm recording the following games, and please do not reveal any results. A few times I would accidentally hear the score, and I would just be so angry because that cost me 3 hours of viewing pleasure.
I remember one time coming out of, I think it was maybe one of Andrew's basketball games, and one of the other parents said something about a game you had taped.
And I remember you covering your ears and I think singing the Notre Dame fight song at the top of your lungs and just like running out of the school.
Yeah, that's true. I must admit, I was pretty ridiculous.
You know, as long as I can remember, Notre Dame was a big part of our lives. We moved around a lot when I was young, but he was always going back to South Bend every year to watch a Notre Dame game at least once. Can you describe what would happen when Notre Dame would lose a game?
Oh, God. It was an apocalypse. I mean, I would be physically ill. Just didn't want to talk to anybody for, you know, maybe a day or two. Fortunately, they didn't lose that many games, but every time they lost, it cut deep.
Do you remember, like, yelling or stomping around the house?
Yes. Again, these are things that now I'm ashamed of, but at the time, I don't know. I have no excuse for it, but sports was everything to me.
You know, just this kind of pent-up anger being unleashed was, it was a little scary for me to see, and I really didn't understand it because, you know, this would happen over and over. If they were on a losing streak, it happened week after week. I hated sports. I just sort of said, I'm going to rebel. I'm going to go completely the other way. I'm going to create my own identity as someone who is the anti-sports girl. You know, why do you think that sports were so important to you?
Well, I came from a dysfunctional family. We had 9 kids. 7 of them were boys. They had all they could do just to keep the family surviving. You know, I couldn't go out for sports because, you know, who was going to take me to practice? And I was a very good athlete. I was frustrated because I couldn't play sports.
Do you remember taking Andrew and Owen to Notre Dame games?
Yes, I do. And I know I didn't take you. For them, it was like this sacred pilgrimage to Notre Dame to watch a football game. But I really didn't think you wanted to go. I really thought you'd be bored there.
One year, the whole family did go. Maybe 4th or 5th grade. We stayed with my dad's friend from college, Tim, and I remember getting up in the morning and they were playing the Notre Dame fight song really loud in the living room, and everybody was getting really worked up and excited. And, you know, I was getting kind of excited, too. I remember sort of feeling that passion of like, oh, my gosh, you know, it's the big game day and we're all here and Notre Dame better win. Then I remember walking around campus and sort of being there lined up on the quad to watch the Irish Guard and the players, you know, march into the stadium.
I can remember Andrew and Owen, you know, struggling to keep up with the pace of the marching band. It was one of the best days of my life. I mean, I loved it.
But then my dad and brother went into the stadium, and my mom and I had to stay outside because my dad did not get us tickets to the actual game. For the next 3 hours or whatever, my mom and I just kind of walked around campus, and I remember it was kind of cold. And I think at that point, I'd kind of gotten excited, like we were on this trip, and it had been such buildup in the morning, and I was kind of, yeah, a little bit bummed out that I wasn't really fully a part of it.
I really thought the girls just weren't interested. If I really thought that they wanted to go, I would have made sure that they went. I really would have. I just didn't think they had any clue.
Growing up, my dad was the general manager of a TV station that aired the Kansas City Royals. So we had access to a media box at Kauffman Stadium. So we would go to the games, but I would have to wear cute little clothes so I would look presentable to the clients. And a lot of times I would just go in and I would take my book and I would sit in the corner of the box. And inevitably one of the clients would come up and say, you know, what are you doing? Why are you reading? Don't you like baseball? And I would be like, no, leave me alone. 15 or 20 years passed where I never paid any attention to sports at all. You know, even though I hated going to the games as a kid,
you know, that somehow transformed over time into this nostalgic memory of watching the Royals games. So then when the Kansas City Royals made it into the playoffs in 2014, I just wanted to see it. So I went to Knuckles, which is our local sports bar in Monterey. I was there with my boyfriend, who is not a sports fan at all. And I was totally into it and paying attention and explaining to him what was going on and why this mattered. You know, it was kind of like, wow, I am my father's daughter. That was fun. I had had a fun October. And then the next year was even better, of course, because that's the year that the Royals won the World Series. So I had had so much fun watching the Royals games that I decided that I would go to a Notre Dame game. They were playing Stanford. We played the Notre Dame fight song in the car on repeat all the way driving up to Palo Alto, watching the game and hanging on every play and cheering until my throat hurt. Ultimately, Notre Dame lost that game by a 45-yard field goal in like the final 30 seconds. On the drive home, you know, of course I had to call my dad and see how he was doing, how he was taking the loss. And I could hear in his voice that he was, you know, sad and disappointed. It was a mellower sadness than what I had experienced as a child. You know, we were able to have a conversation about it and say, yeah, you know, the end result was disappointing, but there'll be another game coming up soon. What do you think about the fact that I'm following sports now?
I think it's amazing. I think it's like, how do I describe it? It's like my eyes were opened up. I can't even believe it. I mean, I'm just so thrilled that you like sports enough to follow them. I want to take you to a game so bad. Absolutely. I won't even take the boys.
They can come too.
Yeah, well, okay, but, you know, I want to sit in the stands next to you. I would love that. And we will do it next season for sure.
I can't wait.
That would be fun.
Liz MacDonald now lives in California, where she works for a university. Her father, Jim MacDonald, lives outside of Washington, D.C., where he's a semi-retired Uber driver. They plan to meet up next year in South Bend. Our story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Jim MacDonald, who explains why he doesn't slam doors and punch pillows anymore when Notre Dame loses.
I finally, grew up. It took me a long time, but I finally realized it's just a game. Just a game.
Not just Jim. Only. Only a game. Can we get him to try that again? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style. Thanks for listening.